or the average magnetization, or the correlation function between two magnetizations in the one-dimensional Ising model. Are there questions from last time? Okay, I'll just start out. The calculation of the partition function is something we did last time. This trace means a sum over all, means one of two things. In statistical mechanics, it means the sum over all possible variables. In quantum mechanics, the trace means the sum over all eigenvalues in any representation. One makes the calculation by taking this summation and converting it into the form in which it is a product of n terms of the form e to the some constant plus another constant times tau 1 being a 2x2 matrix. So one does a transformation of this statistical mechanics problem into a problem of quantum mechanics. One then does a trace over quantum mechanical variables. There are n terms like this. These n terms all commute. So you have n k naught tilde plus k tilde tau 1. Tau 1 takes on two values. It's the sum over those two values, plus 1 and minus 1. And pretty soon you have two terms, which is what we calculated. One term is the hyperbolic cosine of k. The next term is the hyperbolic sine of k. They're each raised to the nth power. And then you say, well, if hyperbolic cosines are always bigger than hyperbolic sines, if n is larger, for real values, the argument, if n is a large number, then it's this term which counts, and this is an approximate answer. Next, we look at the average magnetization. We know what the answer is. The system has a full symmetry between magnetizations that point that way and magnetizations that point that way. This thing is 1 if the magnetization is pointing that way, and minus 1 if it's pointing that way. It's because of that full symmetry, the average over those two cases is 0. However, let's write this out. I'm going to consider the magnetization at point J. As I write it out, I get J terms, or J minus 1 terms, to the left of the quantum mechanical operator, which represents this guy. That quantum mechanical operator is called tau 3. And N minus J plus 1 terms to the right of that. So writing this out in the quantum mechanical form, I get the partition function times the average of sigma is the trace over the Pauli tau matrices. Let's not confuse the Pauli tau matrices, which occur with subscripts, from this tau, which is just a number. The trace over the Pauli tau, over the space of the Pauli tau matrices of e to the minus h times tau times j plus 1, e to the minus h times tau, remaining n minus j plus 1 terms. Now, traces can always be rearranged. It is always true that the trace of A times B is equal to the trace of B times A. That's an identity obeyed by traces in quantum mechanics. So I can take this guy and move it over to here. And pretty soon, I have one simple exponential of this guy multiplied by this guy, which is k naught tilde plus k tilde times tau 1 raised to the power n times tau 3. And I'm going to be summing that over I'm going to be doing a trace. This trace of tau 3 times something or other in tau 1. I can do by summing over the two values of tau 3, over the two values of tau 1 is equal to plus or minus 1. So this is an eigenvalue tau, eigenstate tau 1 equals 1 times tau 3 e to the k naught tilde plus k tilde tau 1 times n, and then an eigenstate tau 1 equals 1. And then the same thing with tau 1 equals minus 1. Same stuff, tau 1 equals minus 1. With the important thing being the tau 3 over there. Now, last time we said that tau 3, that tau 1 applied to a state of tau 3 is plus or minus sigma, has changes the eigenvalue to the opposite. Tau 3 is equal to minus or plus sigma. That is applied to tau 3 equals 1, we get tau 3 equals minus 1, and vice versa. The relationship between tau 1 and tau 3 is the same as the relationship between tau 3 and tau 1. In both cases, it comes from the anti-commutation relation. This anti-commutation relation is the source of this condition. And since it works the same for tau 3 and tau 1, one shouldn't be surprised if tau 3 applied to the state tau 1 is equal to plus 1 gives us the opposite state, tau 1 equals minus 1. So, out comes popping when you do this summation. Tau 3 times tau 1 equals 1 is the state tau 1 is minus 1, and that is orthogonal to the state tau 1 equals 1, so that you get a 0 from this orthogonality condition. Similarly, here, you take tau 1 equals minus 1 multiplied by tau 3. You get a state with tau 1 equals plus 1. This doesn't change the value of tau 1. Tau 1 is minus 1 is orthogonal to tau 1 equals plus 1. You get 0 again. This trace is exactly and precisely 0 for all values of J. In the absence of a magnetic field in the Hamiltonian, the magnetization is 0. I will, you all ought to understand what I just said. It's sort of the simplest kind of thing you can do in operator form of quantum mechanics, and has a lot of the content of quantum mechanics in it. May I go on? I will go on. To do the correlation between two spin operators, sigma j times sigma j plus r, you go through the same kind of story. The partition function times the average of this guy is given by the trace of the operator that takes you from the position j equals 0 to the position j. That's this operator. Then you put in a tau 3 representing this guy. You then go step further on. I'm doing this in the Heisenberg representation. Sorry, I thought I was doing it in the Schrodinger representation. It's the same story, but I have to tell it to you. Yes, I did the thing correctly. You go J steps, you get a tau 3, then you go R steps further, that's this term, and then you complete the thing by doing the remaining steps N minus J minus R plus 1. That's the expression for this product expressed in the quantum path integral language. the path integral says you start out at the left-hand side, you go step along, you put in the thing after the right number of steps, you step along some more, you put in the operator after the right number of steps, and then you finish, put in enough steps to come to the end. We're going to work for large n and not so large r. That gives me a simplified answer, and I want that simplified answer. Once again, we rearrange things by putting this term over on the other side and combining it with this term. When we do that, this right-hand side becomes the trace over tau, that is, the trace over the Dirac matrices of e to the minus n minus r, that is the steps coming up to here. Actually, I moved it over to this side. The j's canceled, the r's didn't, and I got on this side n minus r times the quantum Hamiltonian times the step size times tau 3, e to the minus r h tau, another tau 3. I then took out of the quantum Hamiltonian the term in k naught. The quantum Hamiltonian has a term in k naught tilde and a term in k tilde. The k naught tildes times n are the same on both sides of this equation, and I just took them out. So left-hand side of this is going to be given by taking the eigenvalue tau equals plus 1. That's the eigenvalue that we want to use to get the biggest term, times e exponential of k tilde times n times the correlation function we're after. The right-hand side, once again, we focus on the term in which we have tau is equal to plus 1. That's the term that makes this thing big. The tau equals minus 1 term is much smaller because of this large factor of n here. So we take tau is equal to plus 1, and we tau 1 equals plus 1, and we put it in on the left-hand side. I'm going to, in fact, do this on the blackboard so you can see it happening slowly. We are calculating e to the k tilde times n times the expectation value of the spin at point j times the spin at point j plus r. That is equal to, from this expression, the trace over tau, and that's actually the term with tau 1 is equal to plus 1, because that's the big term. And on the other side, tau 1 equals plus 1. And then we have e to the k tilde times n minus r, e to the k tilde times n minus r. This takes us through n minus r steps, and we come to a tau 3 representing a spin operator. We then go another r steps, which completes our story. There should be a tau 1 in there, and we now go another r steps with a tau 1, and then there's one more tau 3, and then we complete the story by writing tau 1 is equal to plus 1. This gives me E to the k tilde times n minus r times 1. So I'll write it out. E to the k tilde times n minus r times 1. And then I have tau 1 equals plus 1 times tau 3 times e to the k tilde r times tau 1 times tau 3 times tau 1 equals plus 1. Tau 1 equals plus 1 times tau 3 gives us the state with tau 1 equal to minus 1. Tau 3 equals plus 1 times tau 3 gives us the state with tau 1 equals minus 1. This tau 1 then should be converted to minus 1. We then get the result e to the k tilde times n minus r tau 3 gives us tau 1 equals minus 1. We get tau 1 equals minus 1. E to the minus a k tilde times r, because this tau 1 is minus 1. And then we end up with tau 1 equals minus 1. Tau 1 equals minus 1 times tau 1 equals minus 1 is normalized to unity. So the whole answer is e to the k tilde times n minus r from here and r from there. It's n minus 2r. And that is e to the k tilde times n times the correlation function. The result then is, and this is just rewritten here, that the correlation function between a spin at j and a spin at j plus r is an exponential which decays, goes down, as in minus 2 times k tilde times r. This k tilde then reflects the way things vary in space. I've assumed that n is much bigger than r in doing this calculation. This is an important example of what one does in quantum mechanics. And again, I'm making the point that one part of physics and another part of physics all come together in order to do real things. The result is that this spin-spin correlation function falls off exponentially in R, and the coefficient of the exponential is a 2k tilde. We generally write things by saying that correlation functions between something which is at one place and its correlation with something at another place dies away as distance divided by some characteristic distance if it's exponential. Here the characteristic distance is 1 over 2k tilde. That's given the name C, called a correlation length or a coherence length, or I'm just going to tell you that it is an inverse mass in a moment. This C then is evaluated as, this R is not in units of distance. This R says we are n lattice sites away, and if distance is a number of lattice sites times a lattice constant, that is a separation between neighboring sites, then the real way in which things fall off is exponential of distance divided by 2k tilde, or distance divided by coherence length, and then the coherence length is a times 1 over 2k tilde, which we also write is 1 over d of k. That ends the treatment of the one-dimensional Ising model, I think. I'll look at the next slide and I'll see what I really have there. But it doesn't end my discussion of the correlation length. correlation lengths came into physics in a big way with the work of the particle physicist Yukawa. Yukawa had a theory of mesons, and the potential produced by the mesons, the interaction potential between two nuclei produced by the mesons, fell off exponentially in space. So in particle physics, we usually call this distance, which describes how things decay exponentially in space. We usually call this a Yukawa length. And in this case, the Yukawa length is given by a lattice constant times 1 over 2 k tilde. And 1 over 2 k tilde goes, if you look at it in the formulas that came up last time, it goes as an exponential of 2 k as k goes to infinity. Therefore, for very large values of coupling, this correlation length is very large. In fact, as you will see throughout this year, small masses, that is, large correlation lengths, are things that have very important consequences in particle physics, and this is your first opportunity to see a correlation length which is large in comparison to a lattice constant. In any case, we name the correlation length C, and in this particular case, it is the lattice constant divided by 2k tilde. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what happens really in a one-dimensional Ising model. An arrow pointing upward is considered to be a spin-up. An arrow pointing downward is what we call a spin down. Now, because the coupling is e to the k times sigma times nearest neighbor sigma, because of this coupling, these two spins having the same alignment, being both up or both down, is the likely thing. And the likelihood of the opposite, the relative probability of the opposite, goes down as e to the minus 2k. If k is large, that means that the configuration that I showed here with the arrows all pointing in the same direction is the most common configuration. Sometimes, because of a fluctuation, you get what is called the block wall, a situation in which there is a change from spins pointing upward to spins pointing downward, and you get an extra loss of probability right there. That loss of probability is an extra factor of the exponential of minus 2k. This kind of thing in which one thing happens and then there's a change to an entirely different kind of behavior is called a topological excitation. If I'm not mistaken, the colloquium today will be in part about topological excitations in superconductors. And this is the very simplest example of a topological excitation in the condensed matter physics, a change from one kind of order to another kind of order. This topological excitation is much more likely than just flipping a single spin. Flipping a single spin costs you as much energy as two of these Bloch walls. Bloch is incidentally named after Felix Bloch. It's not because this is a block of spins and this is a block of spins, although physicists do like puns, and this block with an O was probably chosen in part for that. In any case, this costs you a factor of e to the minus 2k twice, or a total e to the minus 4k, and this guy costs you only a factor of e to the minus 2k. Therefore, it is the likely excitation. If you have a line of spins which is a zillion long, no matter how big K is, this will happen some number of times. In fact, a zillion times each of the minus 2K times. And that means that there will not be order extending across the whole system. In order to have a ferromagnetic phase, in order to have a situation which looks like a ferromagnet, you have to have order extending over the whole system. And in this one-dimensional case, the existence of these block walls will ruin the possibility of having long-range order. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to do renormalization in the one-dimensional Ising model. How many of you have seen renormalization in the one-dimensional Ising model? Okay, some, two. Do it again. How many have seen renormalization in the one-dimensional Ising model? You and you. Okay. Let me describe how I'm going to do it. I'm going to look at a bunch of spins strung out on the line. I'm going to sum over every second spin and then talk about what kind of problem I have. So let me get some blackboard here, and I will do the specific stuff on the blackboard. This calculation, as it says at the top of that slide, was done independently by David Nelson and myself, I hate to tell you how many years ago, following ideas of Kenneth Wilson. So we have a bunch of spins, numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth. Now let me give you 5. And they're called sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4, sigma 5. They each take on the values plus or minus 1, and the partition function is the sum over all of these guys of e to the k sigma j times sigma j plus 1 product over j. Let's sneak up on this problem by doing it piece by piece. I'm going to sum over every second spin. I'm going to call this guy mu 1, and I'm not going to sum over this one. This will be the next mu, and it's not going to be summed over. Mu 1 is equal to sigma 1, mu 2 is equal to sigma 3, mu 3 is sigma 5, but I'm going to sum over sigma 2 and sigma 4. That's what it says here. We divide the problem into two pieces. One piece is a sum over the mu's, which I'll do later, and the other piece is a sum over sigma 2, sigma 4, sigma 6, and so forth, which I will do now. And doing it now means that I take e to the k sigma 1 times sigma 2 plus k times sigma 2 sigma 3, and I call this mu 2, this mu 1, and I'm going to sum over sigma 2. The notation is one in which all this stuff up in the exponent is called w. W depends on all of the sigmas up there, and you can see there's exponential of w, which depends on all of the sigmas and also depends on the strength of the couplings k, as you see up here. Okay, I'm about to do the sum over the mu's. Luckily, it's very easy to do the sum over the mu's. I get two terms. The two terms look like e to the k sigma 1 plus sigma 3, but that's mu 1 plus mu 2. Plus e to the, that's summing over sigma 2 is plus 1, times e to the minus k times mu 1 plus mu 2. And then that's rewritten here. This result depends on whether mu 1 is different from mu 2 or on whether mu 1 is the same as mu 2. We can write that as a coupling, k prime, which is a product of mu 1 times mu 2, both of these being plus or minus 1, and there's some constant in here which I won't bother calculating. So the new thing that we have to sum over is a new situation in which we're summing. We get the same old z, we're summing over all the mu's, e to the w, which depends on the mu's. And that w, which depends on the mu's, is just of the same form as before, a nearest neighbor coupling, except that we have not k, but k prime, a new coupling, which describes the strength of the coupling between the two mu's. K prime describes the same kind of system. Well, it describes the same system as before, because that's what we were doing, with a new separation between the spins. If we started out with a separation between the spins which had the value A, we now have a new value, A prime, which is twice A. With a new separation between spins, which is twice as big as the old separation. Since the physical system is the same, physical quantities like the correlation length and the energy are unchanged, but their description in terms of couplings and lattice constants is changed. That is, k prime is some new coupling, and that's some function of k, a function which we would know if we did this, if we calculated what this meant. That function of k describes the new description of the same old system as this new value of the lattice constant describes the same old system, but in a new way. This change from A to A prime, or from K to K prime, is called renormalization. We know that the correlation length is A over 2 times some function of K. That function of K we call D of K, the dual of K. It's logarithm, one half the logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent of K, or some blessed thing like that. However, we know that A has just been changed to 2A, and K has just been changed to a k prime, r of k. However, the physical distance, c, which represents the decay of the correlation function over some physical length, doesn't care whether we call the spins sigma or mu, that distance is the same. Therefore, we know that the new coupling obeys d of k prime is twice as big as d of k, in order to keep the condition that we know must be true, that the new correlation length, which is a prime over twice d of k prime, that new correlation length must be exactly the same as the old correlation length, which is a over twice d of k. Since d is a decreasing function of k, we know that the new renormalized coupling, k prime, is smaller than the old coupling. I have now done for you, except for evaluating this new K. Except for the job of evaluating the new K, I have done the job of calculating the result of renormalization. And I think I should calculate the new K for you, so I will on this blackboard. If I get myself untangled here. Let's take the ratio of the two cases, one in which the mu's are the same, the other in which the mu's are different. That ratio of those two cases is e to the minus twice k prime. Let the mu's be equal to, both equal to 1 here. That is, that e to the 2k prime is e to the k plus e to the k times 2 plus e to the minus k times 2. Since I'm picking the two mu's to be the same, ratio 2. Didn't prepare to do the calculation. Let me do the calculation once again. Couplings. When mu 1 equals mu 2 divided by the couplings when mu 1 equals minus mu 2. When mu 1 is equal to mu 2, the coupling is e to the k prime, and when mu 1 is equal to minus mu 2, the coupling is e to the minus k prime, and this constant out in front doesn't matter. If mu 1 is equal to mu 2 is equal to 1, this is equal to e to the 2k plus e to the minus 2k, and if the guys are different, this has a factor of 2. Therefore, the renormalized value of the coupling obeys. E to the 2k prime is equal to e to the 2k plus e to the minus 2k divided by 2. Sorry to screw it up the first time. I didn't prepare myself to do that calculation. So there's the calculation done out in the notes. I told you that the new coupling is smaller than the old coupling, and let's see what happens as we do a renormalization. As we do a renormalization, maybe we start out from a large value of the coupling here called zero, a point called zero. Here's a coupling, a line of couplings going from k equals zero all the way out to some very large value. We do the renormalization, we get a smaller coupling. Another renormalization, why don't we do it once again, sum over half the mu's, we get another value of k, which is smaller yet. Smaller and smaller and smaller, until after many renormalizations, we get very close to k equals zero. K equals zero is a trivial case, which we can calculate everything, and we feel very happy. This picture gives the way the couplings go as you do the renormalization. They flow to weaker and weaker values until you reach what is called a fixed point here at k equals zero. And that fixed point basically describes the qualitative behavior for all values of k. The Ising system in one dimension is always like the weak coupling system. That's what it says here. The system is always in the weak coupling phase, so there is no phase transition. Okay, we are done. Totally, completely, absolutely done with the Ising model in one dimension. The one-dimensional Ising model, we solved it exactly, and then we saw a way of approaching it, which was new, which gave us the notion of what happened. That notion is that as we looked at the system on a rougher and rougher scale, that is, we looked at a larger and larger lattice constant in our minds, we saw that the coupling became weaker and weaker. Now, we can do roughly similar things for the two-dimensional Ising model. However, we don't have quite as simple a situation. I'll describe to you what the two-dimensional Ising model is, and then I'll tell you how we approach it. We have a two-dimensional lattice. There it is. The Hamiltonian divided by Boltzmann constant times temperature is a coupling K times the sum over nearest neighbors of the product of nearest neighbor spins. For example, you have a spin here, and these guys are the nearest neighbors of this spin here. And then you put in a magnetic field, and you have a sum over all positions of sigma r. Each one of these variables is plus or minus one. This is the problem which Mr. Ising did not solve. This problem, this two-dimensional Ising model, has a phase transition and has a very interesting behavior. In the 1940s, a chemist by the name of Lars Ansagers did indeed solve this problem, calculated the sum over all of the spins in question for the two-dimensional Ising model, and found an expression, an exact expression, for the partition function. We won't go that way. We will talk about various approximations. The exact expression is rather hairy, and I'm not going to deal with it. Let me tell you about how this was studied somewhat later by a group at the King's College in London, Cyril Dome, Michael Fisher, Martin Sykes, and others. They figured out that you could calculate the properties of any Ising model, including the two-dimensional Ising model, by doing summations in power series in the coupling constants. Let me, in fact, say what they did, and then tell you on the slide how they did. They calculated the logarithm of the partition function, or the partition function, as a sum of coefficients an times k raised to the nth power. They did the calculation from n is equal to 0 up to about n is equal to 10, or maybe a little further. Now, let me tell you how they did it. Imagine you have in this Ising model, and the Ising model involves what are called bonds. Those bonds are of the form e to the k times sigma sigma prime is what stands between any two dots in this picture. I can write the bond, as I told you before, as the hyperbolic cosine of k plus sigma sigma prime by the hyperbolic sine of k. Sigma sigma prime has two values, plus 1 and minus 1. If it's plus 1, the hyperbolic cosine plus the hyperbolic sine is e to the k and gives us this result. If sigma sigma prime is minus 1, then this is e to the minus k and also gives us this result. This is exactly true. Without straining my algebraic abilities, I can rewrite this as the hyperbolic cosine of k times 1 plus sigma sigma prime times the hyperbolic tangent of k, hyperbolic tangent being hyperbolic sine over hyperbolic cosine. Now I look at this lattice and imagine that each and every one of these bonds was expanded as in this fashion. First, I get twice the hyperbolic cosine of k times the hyperbolic cosine of k, one hyperbolic cosine from bonds in this direction, one hyperbolic cosine from bonds in this direction, a factor of 2 from doing sums over spins at each point. This is raised to n, the number of sites in the lattice. I then get the the sum, I then get the average, that's what this thing means, this is an average, of the products of all on all the bonds of the lattice of 1 plus sigma sigma prime times the hyperbolic tangent of k. So z is some trivial factor, some easy factor, times the average of the products of things of this kind over all of the possible bonds in the lattice. No problem so far? Imagine we had a picture which looked like this, just one bond. There's a sigma here and a sigma prime there. And we're averaging over sigma and sigma prime. But that average over sigma gives us zero because sigma is plus one and minus one with equal likelihood. In order to get a non-zero result, we have to have a product of bonds which are closed, like this square. We get a sigma here and a sigma prime there. We get another sigma prime for here and a sigma double prime from there. Another sigma double prime from this bond and a sigma with four primes on it from this bond. Four primes and no prime from this bond. Every sigma on this kind of thing has been repeated twice. And of course, every sigma obeys sigma squared is equal to one. Therefore, if you have a picture like this, with a hyperbolic tangent from here, and a hyperbolic tangent from there, and a hyperbolic tangent from there, and one from there in this product, then what you have is some non-zero contribution to the sum. In fact, you can get lots of non-zero contributions to the sum. One perhaps from this square, another from this square, another from this rectangle. The only thing is that you have to draw, in making the partition function, all the possible things on the lattice, never having them overlap, never repeating a bond twice, because that's against the rules of what you do here. You do that summation, and you calculate the number of terms with four hyperbolic tangents of k. The number of terms, so in fact, instead of doing a sum in k, as I said here, let me imagine doing a sum in the hyperbolic tangent of k. So I do if I look at only this square, I get four hyperbolic tangents of k. If I look at this square and this square and this rectangle, I have four and about a dozen more, maybe I have 20 hyperbolic tangents of k. And continue doing that until I run out of energy to do the calculation. Once I get a series of this form, let me write it down for you. Once I get once more a series of the form, partition function is simple-minded stuff. Twice the hyperbolic cosine of k squared raised to the nth power. Less simple-minded stuff. The sum from n equals 0 to infinity. Coefficient an hyperbolic tangent of k raised to the nth power. N equals 0. A 0 is 1. A 4, which is the first non-zero term, is the number of different ways you can put squares on this kind of lattice, and is equal to n, and so on to the next guy, which is A8, I believe. No, A6. You get a rectangle like this, and A6, which is 2n, and so on and so forth. So you do that, and you make as long a series as you can, and then you try to guess how this series has a singularity, a mathematical divergence. And in fact, there are tricks for making pretty good guesses. You're better off calculating logarithm of z than z, but it's a simple transformation to go from z to log z. And pretty soon you find that the log z has a structure which you can guess, which seems to go like k minus kc to squared times the logarithm of k minus kc. And pretty soon you see that it seems to be a good expression for what happens in the two-dimensional Ising model. It is a good representation of the singularity that occurs when the coupling is equal to kc. However, that's getting ahead of my story. I go back now to the time in which the series were first investigated. I go back, in fact, to the 1940s once again. And there's another form of expansion which can be done. This form of expansion works at low temperatures. This form of expansion is an expansion in e to the minus 2k, one in the hyperbolic tangent of k, which I showed you here, and another expansion in e to the minus 2k, which I'm about to show you. The one I showed you before is called a high temperature series. I'm about to show you what is called a low temperature series. When k is this large positive number, the most likely thing to happen is that all the spins will line up in the same direction, sometimes in this direction, sometimes in that direction, but all in the same direction. That gives us two possibilities. The next likely thing is that one of those spins will be flipped. Unlike in the one-dimensional case, where there was an interesting topological excitation, here the lowest form of excitation is just the flip of one spin from being pointing in the same direction as all the other guys to pointing in the opposite direction. We can represent that flip of the one spin by. It's a factor of e to the k if it's lined up okay. It's lined up with the other guys. And then there's a factor e to the minus 2k if it's anti-aligned. That's more or less what it says here. We could write each bond. Each bond connecting two spins as e to the k sigma sigma prime, and we can write each bond as e to the k sigma sigma prime is the result from it being aligned, e to the k, times 1 plus delta sigma minus sigma prime, anti-aligned, e to the minus 2k. So from all of the guys lined up, we get a partition function, which is equal to twice, that factor of 2, e to the k times n, for all the couplings that go in the x direction, e to the 2k n for couplings that go in the x and the y direction, and then the result from flipping individual spins. Every time we flip this spin, we have to flip four bonds. We get four factors of e to the minus k. This flipping this guy gives us four spins flipped. Flipping all of these spins in this inside of here, it gives us on each one of these bonds a factor of e to the minus 2k. And so if you're calculating low temperature series, you draw pictures like these pictures with the red lines. They are different from the pictures with the blue lines that I showed you in the last slide. The pictures in the blue lines are along the bonds. The pictures with the red lines cut across the bonds, but they are not entirely dissimilar. In fact, these two pictures that I drew for you, these two pictures that I drew for you look very much the same. So, in order to form a low temperature expansion, we do all the products of terms like this. And the only time we get a product which counts is one in which we can represent the result by the result of flipping a few spins. So we then draw all the pictures, like these pictures with red lines that I just drew here. And every time we draw such a picture, we put in an e to the minus 2k for each bond we cut across. And we then take products of that numbers of e to the 2k, and we get a expansion once more of the partition function. So here are now two different expansions of the partition function. One which applies at low temperature, and there's an expansion in e to the minus 2k, and the other applying at high temperatures, and there's an expansion in the hyperbolic tangent of k. However, it was noticed by Kramers and Vanier, they saw that these pictures look very much alike, that in fact the two kinds of expansions are exactly, precisely, identically the same, except that the variables are different, the low temperature expansion being an expansion in e to the minus 2k, the high temperature expansion being an expansion in the hyperbolic tangent of k. In symbols, what came out is what is two different expressions for the logarithm of the partition function. One expression, which is of the form, this is the low temperature series, which is of the form n times 2k times n, some function of e to the minus 2k. That's the low temperature series. And the high temperature series is n times the logarithm of twice the hyperbolic cosine of k squared times some function, exactly the same function, in fact, of the hyperbolic tangent of k. The low temperature and high temperature series have exactly the same form, except that we change from one variable to another variable. In fact, we change from the hyperbolic tangent of k to this thing, which turns out to be just the dual of the hyperbolic tangent of k. It is, in fact, the hyperbolic tangent of k tilde. The high temperature and low temperature series are exactly the same, except that the variable is replaced by its dual. Kramers and Vanier then were able to argue in the following fashion. They said, let's assume that there's only one place where this function becomes singular, where this function gives us an infinity. That's the assumption that there is one and only one phase transition for positive k in the two-dimensional Ising model. If there's only one place that happens, it must happen the place where this is equal to that, and they then get an expression for the transition temperature of the two-dimensional Ising model. That expression for the transition temperature of the two-dimensional Ising model is that this guy is equal to this guy at the critical value of the coupling. So the critical value of the coupling obeys hyperbolic tangent of kc is e to the minus 2kc. Now we can actually look at the series expansions and see what the numerical work on the series expansion gave. Does it agree with this? Well, yes, it does. Of course it does. This is an exact result. The exact result can be translated into the statement that the hyperbolic sine of 2kc is equal to 1. That's the consequence of this statement. It says here, after a little algebra, we get this. Well, every time I sit down and do the algebra, it takes me 20 minutes. And that's, you wouldn't think that going from something like this to going from to this statement would take that long. But it does. Even the algebra of exponentials is not so simple. This criticality condition was later verified by Ansager's exact solution of the two-dimensional Ising model. As a further consequence of this argument, that you could get two different ways of representing the partition function of the two-dimensional Ising model, you get the fact that the specific heat, is the heat capacity, it is the derivative of the energy with respect to temperature, it is the second derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to temperature. That specific heat is a symmetrical function of T minus TC. And here it is, experimentally, in a material called rubidium-2 cobalt fluoride 4. This is an experiment done by Nordland, Bellinger, King, Jacarino, and Akita to measure the specific heat of this two-dimensional, this material which has sheets in which the interaction are strong in the sheets but weak perpendicular to the sheets. This two-dimensional material, the specific heat was measured, and it turns out to be this value. Here is where the critical temperature is, and as you can see, there is a considerable symmetry around that critical temperature. This study then shows that real materials obey something like what happens in the Ising model, and in that sense it is an important result. This is a real material with which can be represented in a rough fashion by the Ising model, but not in an exact fashion by that Ising model. We've been talking about dual behavior. Let me summarize what we said about dual behavior for the two-dimensional Ising model. We said that we could either express the behavior of the two-dimensional Ising model in terms of a expansion in low temperatures or an expansion in a variable which is the dual variable to this one and high temperatures. These two expansions, these two ways of representing the behavior, are dual to each other in the sense that k has been replaced by k tilde or by d of k every place. The Ising model obeys in an essential way the fact that it is unchanged over a transformation from the variable to the dual variable. Or rather, the two-dimensional Ising model is unchanged by this transformation. This is a combination of the symmetry of sigma, which takes on the values plus and minus 1, and of the behavior of this two-dimensional lattice. Such dual symmetries can be found in lots of other problems. In fact, dual symmetries have become a great scouting out the time. Dual symmetries have become a great subject of study now in elementary particle physics and field theory and string theory. In general, we know how to solve many, many, many models for weak values of the coupling, k going to zero. We don't know very much for these models about how to solve them for strong values of the coupling. However, if you go from a problem to the dual problem, you're going from a problem in which you have, if you go from a coupling to a dual value of the coupling, that dual value of the coupling is strong when the original value of the coupling is weak, but it is also weak when the original value of the coupling is strong. Therefore, whenever you can't evaluate very well the behavior of the Ising model because k is too large, you can look at the dual situation and see what happens for in the dual situation for weaker coupling. Exactly that is done for the various theories now used in various kinds of string theory and particle physics. Dual problems are evaluated at weak coupling in order to understand what happens to the original problems at strong coupling. This is then a very important kind of way in which we learn about the different problems in particle physics. Okay, we have now then 8 minutes. What should I do with my 8 minutes? Okay. Duality then depends on both the structure of the lattice, the structure of space, and the structure of the variable. The variable here is said to obey a Z2 symmetry, that is a symmetry between plus and minus 1. I'm going to tell you a little bit about something about what happens to the three-dimensional Ising model. I can't draw a picture of the three-dimensional Ising model. I'm miserable at drawing three-dimensional pictures. However, I can tell you what the dual of the three-dimensional Ising model. So we make a dual transformation. That is, we look and see what the dual of the three-dimensional Ising model is. Every place else I've told you exactly, sort of step by step, how things are done. Here there's a whole jump. I'm not going to tell you step by step, but I will tell you what comes out as a problem. What happens is that you get a three-dimensional problem. So this is 3D. You get a three-dimensional problem with a bunch of cubes. Here are a bunch of cubes. I will draw precisely one cube because I can do that much. On each vertex of each cube, there is a variable sigma. So this is a dual transform of three-dimensional Ising model, which we understand roughly how it behaves, although we don't have an exact solution of it. On each one of these vertices, there's a variable. I'll call it sigma r, sigma s. In fact, I will look and tell you how these variables are coupled to each other. They are coupled on each face of each square. So I have a sigma 1 variable on this here, a sigma 2 there, a sigma 3 there, a sigma 4 there. And this square is given the name of a plaquette. The couplings are of the form a coupling constant, or maybe we should say a dual coupling constant, times sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4. Nope, that's not what I said here. So let me say it differently. It's sigma 1, 2, sigma 2, 3, sigma 3, 4, sigma 4, 1. What I said was that there will be a variable defined on each edge of the square. Sorry to change in midstream. I forgot what I did on this slide. The structure of the coupling in the Plaquette is sigma 1, 2 times sigma 2, 3 times sigma 3, 4 times sigma 4, 1. This is a very interesting structure. Since I have these variables like sigma 1, 2 that I'm summing over, I can make the transformation. I can make a transformation at each vertex of this square. I can say sigma 1, 2 goes into sigma 1, 2 times mu 1 times mu 2, with mu 1 and mu 2 being separately equal to plus or minus 1. So I can make a transformation individually at every point in space. This kind of transformation is called a gauge transformation. You are familiar with it from electrodynamics, in which one makes a transformation produced by a variable, usually produced by a function usually called lambda, at every point in space. Here is a gauge transformation which occurs within a statistical mechanics problem. This gauge transformation is an invariance of this dual problem of the three-dimensional Ising model. As a result, we know a lot about what happens with this problem which has a gauge symmetry and is the dual of the three-dimensional Ising model. We know it has a phase transition. We also know that for each and every sigma, the average of sigma is equal to zero. So this is a funny problem, unlike other phase transition problems. In the ordinary Ising model, these variables are magnetizations, and they have an average which is equal to which is different from zero in the ordered state. This dual problem to the three-dimensional Ising model has a different character, and the different character is very much like the character of electrodynamics. Electrodynamics, or in fact quantum chromodynamics, have gauge symmetries in which you can make transformations at every point in space. We learn about what happens with problems with these gauge interactions by looking at this funny transformation of the three-dimensional Ising model. So I have now ended up talking about the way one structures problems on a lattice. You'll find a little more about this in your notes. I will next time tell you how the renormalization group works for the two-dimensional Ising model, and tell you how one can do a simplified version of renormalization for that problem, and something about the structure of phase transition problems. After that, we will go into the behavior of random walks in d-dimensional space, and we will have some fun with the dynamics of random walks. But for now, I should ask whether there are questions or comments. Please look at the notes carefully. It's all in the notes. When you find stuff that you really don't understand, I'll be happy to listen to questions and try to answer them. Okay, we're done. anyone else find this room too hot for? Yes. If nobody else found it, I'll just take off my shirt next time.